Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Bruno Barron, Charlie Kirk, John McCarron, and John McDonough. Our program tonight, coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us on this Memorial Day weekend. Our phone number, 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, we're at btb@museum.tv. If you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's beyondthebeltway.com. And if you'd like to tweet us a question, it's at btbdumont. In this broadcast this evening, we're going to be talking about Memorial Day, what it means. We're going to do it as the president is visiting troops in Afghanistan. We'll talk more about that in depth a little bit later on. But again, we're going to lead off with a story that's been dominating the news for the last 24-plus hours, and that is the shooting in Santa Barbara, California, involving a young 22-year-old man. And I want to begin by talking about what happens instantly whenever guns are involved. It immediately turns into, at least the news media tends to turn it quickly into, a discussion of gun rights. And so and the need for gun laws. It's already happened. One of the fathers of one of the victims gave a very emotional outburst, naming the National Rifle Association and castigating for politicians for not really doing something. And again, if you're a parent, or even if you're not a parent, it's a very sympathetic and tragic response from a father that is devastated by the loss of his son. I want to put that in context with those that have an opportunity to go on the web and read a report of the parents, the anguish of the parents of the shooter in this particular case. Elliot Rogers is his name. He's 22 years old. He took his own life. In a video that is available on the web, he paints a very dark picture, a very sinister picture of why he did what he did. It basically is because, as a young man, he felt rejected by women, and he wanted to take retribution. And so he wanted to go to the sorority house and really devastate lives and kill people. That's the reason he gave. But the story that is available out there, if you want to take a look at it and do some searching for it, is really the tragic story of a mother. It was a broken family, a second marriage in California. It's the tragic story of a young mother or mother desperately trying to reach police to try to warn them of what she thought the son was capable of doing. It's a tragic story, and again, I invite you to read that story, search for it. Again, it is every bit as devastating as the video that is available, which is already being used by one side in this debate. So I don't know whether there's a real answer here in this particular case. This was a young man who came from a fairly wealthy family. He had had psychiatric treatment for quite some time. The psychiatrists were in touch with his parents, again, from a broken family. But he was following the mental health rules. He was doing what we've, after all of these events, we talk about what can parents do. Well, these parents were doing it. The shooter himself was doing it. The guns were purchased legally in the state of California. So there wasn't anything nefarious about how he got his guns. And we have to look at the reasons. I mean, for every young man, 22 years old, who believes he's not attractive to members of the opposite sex and wanting to go and literally murder women who were not attracted to him and murder men who he thought were less than him. I mean, so we were getting into the mind of something that probably goes on, you know, hundreds of thousands of times in anyone's life. And so, John McGunn, I want to begin with you. You're a father. You're a journalist. Where do we go with a story like this? I mean, is this one of many, many stories that really there is no answer to a story like this?
I see it pretty much in that way. It's an anomaly. I don't want to live in a society in which you can be arrested or imprisoned for a crime that somebody thinks you might commit some point in the future. Mental illness seems to be the focus of a lot of these kinds of crimes, how to ferret it out, how to identify its potential. But there again, if we're irritated at the degree of surveillance that NSA seems to be, you know, heaping on the country now, and it's gone to excess, I can't imagine the weight of surveillance that would be on those who have any mental problems at all.
Bruno Behrend, one of our Republicans, although this is not a Republican-Democratic issue, I don't believe, but your take on can these stories ever be stopped in any way?
I don't think so. I mean, the fact is we're going to have these kinds of things happen in a country that has a diverse population of people who may or may not be mentally ill, and and people are going to take action like this. I will say this, and I don't apologize for it. As horrible as these stories are, none of them rise to the occasion of taking away the guns of 200 or 300 million or 225 million law-abiding gun owners. Based on what you were saying, it's almost as if the police had gone just a little bit farther, or the mother who tried had gone just a little bit farther. A crime like this could have been averted, as just a few weeks ago a crime was averted by a neighbor who saw somebody piling up bombs and guns in a storage container and reported it. So these are preventable. I will say this one last thing. If the NRA wants to head something like this off at the pass, if these things happen, they should do something about making it more difficult for the mentally ill to attain weapons, and if they are mentally ill, to make sure that they don't have access to them.
Well, in the state of California, you can be denied if you have a mental illness and you have been treated for it and you have been basically put away for it. Mm-hmm. If you're not doing it in a voluntary way, even in the state of California, where there's a six-month waiting period, it doesn't help in any way. John McCarron, you were also a father and a journalist. Where do you come in on this discussion?
I think there are too many guns. And I've been listening to Beltway the last few weeks. And normally, Bruce, you wait until you're about 60 minutes into the show before you go into your rant about the liberal media, want to do this and liberal media that. Now here you sort of preempted this discussion by saying, well, you know, the media is going to play this. It's too many guns and misreading the Second Amendment.
But they are. They are.
Well, I hope so. I hope they do. Because they're right about that. I mean, this is madness.
But let me defend myself. And as this particular case goes, what I find offensive about this is that you have the father, Richard Martinez. He's the father of one of the victims. He gets on television and he creates this horrible, you know, he's a devastated father. They put this guy on television when he's in a devastated state. And the point I was making with my opening comments tonight is there's another devastating part of this story that they don't have video on, John. It's the one that requires some reading in a newspaper and reading the devastation and the tragedy of the parents trying to find help from their children.
He speaks for millions of parents out there who are really paranoid that there's so many guns out
really
there.
Really quick.
We got to go to a break. I want to give you a chance, Charlie Kirk, and also follow up on this. But again, we're out of time for segment number one. 1-800-723-8029. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce, back in Chicago, we turn now to Charlie Kirk. You're the only one. You're not a parent. You are young enough to be the son of somebody, as you are, as everybody is. Your reaction to this story, again, it's a 22-year-old kid that we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, I think it's outrageous to blame guns for this. Let's remember that three of the deaths, it began with him stabbing three of his friends with a knife. No one's calling for, you know, banning knives from private citizens. I think it's completely outrageous to blame this on too many guns, or to say that we need some sort of new gun policy or gun laws. This is a tragedy, first and foremost.
And
it's a tragedy.
These weapons were purchased from federally licensed dealers in a state that has pretty strict gun laws.
By his parents?
No, they were purchased by him.
By him.
Well, and look, no matter what policy you have in place, no matter how you try to outlaw guns, and no matter, there's always going to be things that fall through the cracks, and tragedies happen. It just does. But to say, and this is what really frustrates me, I watched the Sunday morning talk shows, and they had some commentators saying, and this is just another example why we need to ban assault weapons. And what is an assault weapon? That's a made-up term, first of all. Second of all, to try to blame when three of the deaths were done by stabbing, this was just a tragedy, first and foremost. This is not anything. I mean, I would say that Sandy Hook would have been more indicative to put forth a gun policy agenda or gun confiscation than this. This was just a tragedy, first and foremost, and try to politicize it, I think, is really disappointing.
John.
Well, I don't see what Elliot Rogers, the guy who, you know, went crazy because I guess he couldn't get laid. I don't see what that has to do with a well-regulated militia. I think we have a, you know, fundamental, ongoing, crazy misinterpretation of the Second Amendment. Now, I mean, John makes a good point. He says there are so many guns out there that it's probably too late to put the genie back,
right,
back in the bottle. But, I mean, that father you talked about, I think he speaks for a lot of folks. And, you know, here in Illinois, we're just going through the trauma of a concealed carry. I mean, we have a reasonable, moderate state. We held out for as long as
right.
we could. Finally, you know, we have this judge, Richard Posner, who said, oh, no, we're all safer if we have guns, and therefore we have to conform with, you know, Sam Alito's concealed carry SCOTUS opinion. So now suddenly we have stickers on every restaurant and public
no guns.
Venue. You know, can't bring your gun in here. It's just, you know, a omnipresent, crushing, I think, part of life now in Chicago and Illinois, and I think I'm overreacting to that a little bit, yeah, because.
But again, I want to go back to the tendency of, you know, politicizing it, and you know, you took exception to my opening comments because I did talk about the news media. The news media in this particular case had a grieving father. I mean, his 20-year-old son had just been murdered, so they get the video they want. This irate parent, this distraught parent talking about, you know, politicians and talking about the NRA. He names the NRA. He blames them. Now, this fits into the thumbnail sketch that I believe exists in most newsrooms in America. If we can run an anti-NRA thing, we're going to run it. And in this particular case, you have a devastated father. And my juxtaposition in bringing that up is the other devastating parents in this particular case are the parents of Elliot Rodger.
I don't know that they've gone before the cameras yet, though, have they?
No, they haven't. They haven't. And I bet when they go, if people read the story of his mother reaching out to the you know, the father in this particular case, a minute by minute account of what they were trying to do in the minutes leading up to their son mm-hmm. completely going, you know, berserk or whatever the term we want to use. I mean, it's they too have a tragedy, but because the media doesn't, because we don't have them crying on camera, that devastation is not heard yet. It's the frustration.
That was very dramatic video, Bruce, and it would have been impossible for the networks to consider not running it. It was the emotional reaction of a grieving parent.
But the networks, no. What I'm saying. The networks also chose not to run the piece of video with Elliot Rodger looking into camera, smirking, and talking about that he wanted to literally annihilate women at the sorority house. He wanted to go into the hottest sorority
house.
I think
house. That's a politically driven decision.
Absolutely.
No. I'm not so sure about that, but I want to get everybody else's mm-hmm. response to it. Mm-hmm. All I'm just saying is that the other one would have clearly shown that this guy was literally deranged.
Well, I heard the video you were referring to. I think I might have heard it on the radio, so it probably would have been on NPR.
Well, it is available. It is available on websites. So
I did not get it on the computer.
Nobody used it on television.
Nor
would they have used 6 minutes and 55 seconds
right.
of it.
Well, Bruce, I think I may disagree to some degree here with what John said earlier regarding institutionalization. I think there is a case to be made. that the deinstitutionalization that took place in the 70s and early 80s has posed problems, some safety problems for Americans, and that at some point in time, every parent and the whatever the system is, the health system out there, if we're going to be talking about mental health, there is a reason to institutionalize people who may be a threat. And you know, again, it's amazing to me that the minute something like this happens, the first thing people do is go after the millions and millions of law-abiding gun owners who may use it for hunting or self-defense or whatever they want to have it for. They immediately want to go after the instrumentality, but they never want to go after the mentality of the people who are the most likely to, and they're actually fairly easy to find.
But I'm not so sure that they are easy to find.
In this particular
case, you had a young man who had seen a therapist for several years. I mean, he was going to therapy. He had parents who were well-to-do enough to send him to therapy.
Well,
you know,
I
wish that everyone could do it. My concern is all the people out there who don't have wealthy parents, and so they run around with these same inner demons, but they don't even have a therapist. And
institutionalizing,
we can't even blame mental health on this.
Institutionalizing somebody is in effect punishing them before the crime has been committed, though.
Yes,
and I mean we get into and when you
stigma.
There's a due process for that though. When you see the excess that this particular side of the argument can go to, and you read about a 7-year-old boy being suspended for school for 3 days because he makes a gun gesture with his finger.
Right.
I mean, then you're talking about a ridiculous kind of extremism in the other direction.
Charlie. There is another component. I think this has been a problem of just culture in general. This kid was not only starving, for girls to have attention, but he wanted attention in general. And now his picture has been posted on every single major network across the country. And look at what kind of culture that we've been created in. The Boston bomber was on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine last summer. What kind of message does that send to these kids that have these inner demons or look at starving that attention?
What do you suggest? Do you suggest that we don't show the picture?
No, there's no good answer to it, unfortunately.
Well, actually,
the networks decided they weren't going to show the 6 minute and 55 seconds.
Well, we have a free press, so we have a First Amendment. We also have a Second Amendment, and John McCarran thinks that we overinterpret one and we interpret the other one properly. But if we're going to talk about going after the civil rights of 250 million gun owners, why don't we go after the media and just say make a law and saying the media can no longer cover mass shootings because they do too much to create more mass shootings. I mean, I'm not proposing
that.
You're
being facetious.
I'm being facetious, sure. I think it kind of fits to a point. If the media covered these in different ways, and they said, well, we're gonna just do some news things voluntarily, but if they basically said we're gonna just do this and that and the other thing, we're not gonna sensationalize it, and we're gonna cover it for 24 hours and we're gonna stop. The number, I think you could make the case that the number of these things would go down.
But that's true, but in this particular case, what is also apparent is that the parents, at least the mother in this particular case, she was aware of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
There was a relative that had read something that he had put on his email. They came home. They rushed home. They went into his YouTube account. How many parents could even get into their kids' YouTube accounts?
Mm-hmm.
These parents did that. They saw it. They called the police. The police went out. They interviewed the kid. The kid seemed relatively okay. They didn't say, hey, can we go in and look in your bedroom? They didn't do that.
And had they, it would have been averted.
Had they done that, they would have found weapons. They would have found legally purchased weapons.
Had there been a national database of weapon ownership, they might have been able to consult the database and know that going into the interview. But there is no such database.
Is that a good idea?
No.
You know what? I'm neutral on some of these things, and I don't toe the NRA line on some of these things. And last time we talked about it on this show a few years ago or months ago with some other folks, the issue becomes trust. Would I be okay with a database in a situation like that? It would be. I would be okay with such a database if I trusted the government not to use that database to confiscate
some later
point.
John, let me ask you the question. Mm-hmm. You want the government to have a database of people that own weapons. Do you want a database of the people in this country that go to seek psychiatric help?
Well, we have a database of people who own automobiles. Seeking mental health, seeking
in therapy.
Therapy.
Let's use this kid as an example. This kid is in therapy. He's going on a regular basis. He's going to a therapist. Should he be on a database so the people in the state of California or anywhere, any federally licensed dealer where he
like
bought these
offender weapons?
Like
a sex offender.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Should they
be? A sex offender, you're dealing with people who have committed the crime already.
So what is the answer to my question?
With what you're suggesting is the
I'm following up on what you've suggested.
Yes, you know, I know. Off the top of my head, I think it's worth considering. But then you get into the issues of the civil rights of the mentally disturbed. And
that's why I think
this is something that's worth some conversation.
John,
I think
any such database? We've got 15 seconds.
I'd say probably to err on the side of yeah, but I mean, Bruce, the nation is awash in high-powered, high-capacity weapons. It's the elephant in the room, and we're talking about the mice on the floor, the media, this and that. We've got a problem here with the firepower on the street, lots of it.
Every day, guns save lives.
And we have a problem of many mentally ill or potentially mentally ill people walking around there. And they're not getting help. In this case, he was getting help, and obviously. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us this Memorial Day weekend. A program note, in the next hour of our broadcast, we are going to be joined via phone from California. Neel Kashkari Carey is a Republican who wants to be the next governor of the state. You may recall that a couple of months ago on this program, Tim Donnelly, who is a member of the General Assembly or the Assembly, State Assembly, who's also in that campaign, was a guest on this program. And so out of fairness and balance, we will have Neel Kashkari make his case, and that'll be in the last half hour of our broadcast tonight. Let me introduce our guests, or let me introduce them so they can introduce themselves. We start with my good friend, John McCarron.
We are good friends.
We are good friends.
We've known each other
for a long
time. Or I
wouldn't invite you back so many
times.
Tonight's
opening comments notwithstanding. No, my name is John McCarron. I, a longtime reporter at the Chicago Tribune, where I worked finally as a member of the editorial board, editorial writer. I'm doing a little teaching at DePaul University now in their journalism program. And I do some freelance writing for not-for-profit groups here in Chicago.
Sure. And Bruno Barron.
My name is Bruno Barron. I'm a senior fellow at the Heartland Institute. I'm on the board of directors of an organization called American Transparency, and we have an app called Open the Books, where we are trying to put every state, local, and federal dollar spent in America online in an app so you can see government spending from your smartphone, and we're becoming quite successful at that. We're about one-third the way done, and when I'm not doing that, I do some freelance political consulting for anybody who's smart enough to hire me.
John McDonough.
John McDonough. Senior fellow at the McDonough Institute.
And
can't be impeached. I do some teaching at Northwestern University. I was with the Chicago Tribune early on in the pre-Clayton Kirkpatrick era, the old days. I'll tell you some stories about those days sometime. So that's me.
Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk, founder of Turning Point USA, a national student movement, educate, empower, and mobilizes young people around free markets, fiscal responsibility, and limited government. Write a little bit for National Review, Washington Times, and lots of other news outlets.
Let me put in a plug here again, a major benefit for the Museum of Broadcast Communications coming up on June 21st. It will be a salute to Dick Cavett. You can go to museum.tv. Should you want to come to the big event, tickets are $125. They're within reach. And again, it's going to be dancing and Dick Cavett and food and drink and a lot of fun and a good way to support the Museum of Broadcast Communications. And that event will kick off a two-month salute or tribute or retrospective, I should say, on Dick Cavett and the great interviews that he has done throughout his illustrious career as one of America's top talk show hosts.
Will there be ballroom and swing dancing?
There will be. It'll be the Alan Gressick Swing Shift Orchestra. Thank you for asking.
No house music, please?
No house music, no.
Good, excellent.
No techno. There will be no techno music. And again, Dick will leave everybody in the Woof and Poof song. If you're a Yaley out there, you want to come support Dick Cavett, one of your most famous alums. I want to kind of switch gears from our discussion of the situation that took place in Santa Barbara, the shooting, which six lives were lost, including the alleged self-inflicted wound on the shooter. And I want to switch gears and talk about Memorial Day. It is Memorial Day. On this Memorial Day, President Obama went in the middle of the night, went over to Afghanistan, where he visited with the troops today, brought Brad Paisley along to entertain the troops. He talked about, again, the sacrifice. He talked about the way in which the troops obviously will be coming home from Afghanistan by the end of the year, which was a campaign pledge that he made. And on this Memorial Day, we are surrounded with each Memorial Day by opportunities, as we will have tomorrow when the official commemoration takes place, for the nation to stop and pay tribute to the men and women who gave their lives. This happens at a time when those who gave their lives or left limbs in faraway places are the subject of perhaps the most devastating scandal of all to face this administration, and that is the VA scandal. Problems with the Veterans Administration are not new. They're not new to this president. It seems to me that every 4 years we talk about every candidate wants to do something better for the veterans, and yet we have this horrendous scandal. So let me begin with our Republican, Bruno Barron, and get your thoughts on we talk, when I say we, I mean the country and Republicans and Democrats, all talk about the veterans, how much we love the veterans, mm-hmm. have a deep thought in our heart for them. But we don't treat them very well, do we?
Probably not as well as we should. We always say we're going to. Of course, we have big budget issues, and we have all sorts of health care issues. So when money gets shortchanged, they have to move the shell around somewhere and see how they can do some cuts. Our organization opened the books. We actually did some analysis on the first hospital that were in Phoenix, where the first wave of the scandal hit. 51% of the spending goes to administration and operations of the building. 41% of the spending actually goes to actual health care. The solution here, and I don't really know where you want to blame or lay the blame or how much I'm not a big fan of Barack Obama, but this is not his fault. This is a bureaucracy.
He's back for years. Right?
And what we have to do, and this would be my idea, we need to stop funding. We have a very good program where we send the kids to college, but we don't have VA colleges. We need to mothball VA hospitals. We need to mothball the entire concept of serving people inside these large bureaucracies, and we just need to voucherize that money so that the money follows the veteran to the benefits that they need.
John, is that a good idea?
I think the voucher program's been done before, and I think it's a pretty good idea in terms of collecting some of the overflow that the VA can't handle. I don't think the VA is a I don't think you can build a case of All government medical care is bad based on the VA. The VA has done some tremendous work and has a very good history of providing care for our veterans over the years. And despite the various
that is certainly not the anecdotal evidence I've had in 60 years of life.
Despite a lot of anecdotal evidence and scandals and whatnot, I mean, the VA started off on the wrong foot. Charles Forbes was the first VA administrator, and he was swallowed up in Teapot Dome. He accepted a $5,000 bribe at the Drake Hotel about 12 blocks north of here once.
Charlie, let me ask you. Thank you for that historical. I appreciate
right.
that. Is it a mistake to segregate the veterans from everyone else that needs health care? I mean, should we eventually work for, moving and ending the VA as we know it?
Oh, absolutely. We're doing a disservice to the people who gave everything to our country to put them into a government bureaucracy that doesn't work, and now that we're learning, has incentives to actually have some people die so that they can maximize their own bonuses. Now, that's not a political statement. That's just the reality of what happened here in Phoenix.
Should they go right into Medicare?
No, I would say a quick solution right now. If they really wanted to solve it in the next 6 weeks, say anybody who cannot get treatment in the next week, you would now have a Medicare card, go get treatment. That doesn't solve it long term, but it gets people that are without limbs, need treatment, into the system. It works for our the people and the elderly people of 65 and over. And say, give them a Medicare card, get them service. This cannot be acceptable for our veterans.
John McCarron, your reaction.
Yeah, one of my first assignments at the Chicago Tribune was to go into the VA hospitals, interview vets. We had a charity every Christmas called Cash for Yanks, and I wrote about veterans, a lot of them back from Vietnam. But one of the first things you notice when you get inside veterans' hospitals is, it's not Walter Reed. It's not by and large, younger people who are returning with gross injuries, trauma, you know, from mm-hmm. the wars. I mean, those people are there, but they're a minority. I mean, what you see a lot of is are older guys who have no other health insurance but have that DD-213 piece of paper that says that they served, and that lets them get into the system and get health care. So, I mean, and part of what we're talking about, I think, is, you know, people with chronic mm-hmm. Conditions, diabetes and whatnot, and of old age. So maybe, I mean, the fault may be that we don't have a system that accommodates those folks.
What about
in the free market?
What about the suggestion that Charlie just made, that maybe what we really should have is that we should move towards abolishing the VA and let those veterans
only
who earned it go into any hospital?
Only if you could price control the kind of gouging that goes on in the private sector.
That's through competition. We all know that's how you keep prices down. But Bruno,
I think, like, again, going back to the analysis of all the job listings, and when we asked for the data dump and looked at the job listings, the hospital in Phoenix, and I'm sure all of the big hospitals have something very similar. So there was this huge number, something as high as 10% of the salaries, if you aggregated them all together, for loan specialists. Now, obviously, one of the other benefits that that veterans get are VA loans. But you don't need to create a loan bureaucracy. We have a banking system. We have a mortgage system. You just say, you are a veteran. Here's the benefits you get. You get health care. This is how you're going to get health care. You get VA loans. You get loan benefits to buy houses. Here's how you get your loan benefits. We don't. And this is my same view on education and everything else I talk about. We do not need to create massive bureaucracies for every benefit we want to confer on a group of people who have worked for us.
John McKenna.
I think the idea that the veterans of our wars deserve some sort of special consideration in terms of medical care it's been there from the beginning of this country,
right?
The Revolutionary War. However, it was handled, you know, privately. It was handled by states in those days, and it was only the impact of World War I that really pushed it into the level of a national obligation, and that's when the Veterans Bureau, I think it was called,
was formed. To what extent back, historically, and again, we're about to go to a break, but I always want to ask the question. Mm-hmm. To what extent was the VA set up not only to provide service to those who served their country, but were there politicians at the time that preferred to have them segregated in some way so that not being part of a general hospital population would not remind people of what happens when you send people to war?
No, I've never
heard. Because they come back
I've
without limbs.
That. I've never, I've
and
never
that
thought
part of
that
it is
before.
The segregation, mm-hmm. and maybe that's something that needs to end. Think about that. We'll talk more about it when we come back. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We continue our discussion of the VA scandal and also the treatment of veterans when they come back. Charlie, you wanted to make a point.
Yeah, the one thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, we blame the bureaucracy, and this is not a political issue, but more a question, you know, I want to pose to everybody here. Why hasn't President Obama held anybody accountable for this in the short term? Why hasn't Shinseki come out and said, we're going to fire these people, we're going to make these changes? I mean, I hate to make this example, but if anything like this ever happened in a private, like publicly traded company, could you imagine if nobody would be held accountable? I mean, we have a department of our government that is subsidized by U.S. tax dollars that has really, I mean, no one is to blame right now. We're just going through another bureaucracy, and that's how these bureaucracies
are. People have died
created.
Because of it.
People are dead. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are dead veterans.
Well, I can understand the idea of wanting to, you know, sort out who's to blame and who's not to blame. So I think, you know, some time needs to be allowed on this one. But my point during the break was that the Veterans Bureau was conceived after World War II or after World War I, and it was really the first. This was at a time in the beginning of the 20s, when the national government had no sense of any obligation to provide health care for the country. But in the wake of World War I, the military was considered an exception. The United States did have a special obligation to soldiers, and the Veterans Bureau was the result of that. And it's evolved, you know, over many years through its ups and downs, and there are about 150 or 200, you know, veterans hospitals in the country now. Some of them, I've seen.
But what surprises me is that
if there's
any group that is out there, mm-hmm. that is, insofar as its voting patterns, I mean, from a bipartisan standpoint, there isn't anybody out there that would survive in politics if you don't stand up and wrap yourself in the flag around a veteran. Mm-hmm. And yet this scandal continues to grow. And I think, you know, and I've heard complaints about this, decades ago. This is not new. I mean, the idea of somebody cooking the books, which has been discovered coming out of Arizona. Now, that's sort of a smoking gun in this particular case.
Well,
but I get back to, you know, it's just we treat veterans differently than everyone else. Do they deserve it? I think most politicians would say, yes, they do deserve it. They deserve it because they stepped up and took on a job and a responsibility when other people did not want to do it.
Well,
they were forced to do it.
We've been atoning for our treatment for many years of the way we treated Vietnam veterans, because I think in Vietnam there was the error of confusing the soldier with the policy, and they tended to get the blame for it, and they were treated badly. And I think for the last 40 years there's been an attempt to kind of restore that respect for the soldier.
I agree with you that I don't think anybody has a problem with saying, okay, these people, it's a volunteer military and they're taking tremendous risk. They're sacrificing not only life and limb, or potentially sacrificing that, but they're also getting not very much pay. So giving them benefits throughout their life, I don't see that as the problem. What I see is the problem.
Nor do I.
I don't think any of us do. But the problem is you don't have to do that through failing bureaucratic systems that are more about employing people, and this is my same critique of the public education system, and it's my same critique of many, many governmental systems at the state and federal level. The bureaucracy is not what's helping the veterans. As a matter of fact, we now know that it's failing to help them. So let's find ways to help the veterans, and let's stop finding ways to dump more money into failing bureaucracies.
Well, it seems to me that, following up on what Charlie said earlier, I mean, if every single veteran had their card and they could walk in, if they needed a loan, they walked into the bank, they'd go to the front of the line. They went into a hospital, they'd go to the front of the line, they would be treated.
Yes.
Right. They want to go back to school, they see the dean of admissions, they got their little card.
And if
Obama... If we're going to hold the veteran out as someone who has done something exemplary,
right,
served their country, we should serve them better,
right,
in all areas.
Yes.
And instead of going through a huge bureaucracy that systemically has not worked, certainly we have evidence, hard evidence now, that it's not working. A card that literally it's their gold card.
Well, that's why the Veterans Bureau was originally formed, because
the intentions were there, it just hasn't worked.
All right, well, you know, there's nothing really that's wrong with the veterans hospitals that probably money can't fix one way or another.
It's way overfunded. He just told you 51% 51% went towards administrative costs. You look at the waste in these hospitals, it is criminal. It is worse care than people on Medicaid get. Medicaid, people, the poorest people in America, get higher quality care than our veterans, and that is a disgrace. And, you know, I am upset because I know veterans that serve this country that are 21 and 22 that are more scared to go to the VA than they were to go to Baghdad. Mm-hmm. And that is a crime to treat our veterans like that on this Memorial Day. Yeah. And I'm sorry. I don't think we should tolerate it as
Americans. Tell us how you really feel, Charlie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
John, what about it?
I
like my idea of a card?
I'm intrigued by the idea of vouchers. I think there was something to the bureaucracy. I think Charlie is trying to get – he's not getting political. He's getting ideological. You know, he's a small government guy, and there is a danger with bureaucracy. So I'm intrigued by the idea of vouchering gradually stand down the hospital system.
Vouchers were issued to women veterans for pregnancy and mm-hmm. maternal things before the VA, you know, had that capacity. That's how they would serve women in that particular area. That's where the voucher system sort of got some traction in this
When we come back, by the way, and by the way, if you're watching this program on television, we're going to say goodbye to you. But if you're listening to the show on radio, we're going to continue for another full hour. Again, Neil Kashkari, who's running for governor of California as a Republican, will be one of our guests at the back end of the broadcast in the next hour. But I want to continue a discussion, John, that you basically brought up the last time you were on this broadcast, and that is it's a further expansion of the way we treat veterans. And again, we will continue that discussion as we roll on from Memorial Day 2014 from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for being with us. And again, if you're watching us on television, don't forget tomorrow, take that time to give thanks and bow your head a little bit to honor those that gave their lives for this country, not those that survived. Those that did not. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly.
Television interviewers of all time. The legendary Dick Cavett is coming to Chicago.
There's a certain excitement in the air.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications presents a salute to Dick Cavett, Saturday, June 21st at 6:30.
But this is me. I'm letting it all hang out.
Spend an evening with a television legend.
Why don't we see how the show is?
A salute to Dick Cavett. Go to museum.tv for your tickets now.
Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway this evening, featuring Bruno Barron from the Heartland Institute, Charlie Kirk from Turning Point USA, former Tribune reporter, now with DePaul University, John McCarron, and John McDonough, a writer and contributor to National Public Radio. Our program tonight coming to you from the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Toll-free lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. Want to join us on the World Wide Web, it's beyondthebeltway.com. That's where we have podcasts of all previous broadcasts, some of the telecasts as well. And, John, as we continue our commemoration of Memorial Day and talking about the role of veterans in our society and how the VA has let them down in many cases. John, the last time you were on this program, you were making a point about the way in which we treat veterans and who veterans are. And you basically asked the question whether or not it's possible to have died in vain for an unpopular war. Now, as you can imagine, I was inundated with irate emails.
Yeah, I don't think we had
following that
to,
because fully, we sort of ran out of time.
Fully air that one. Yeah.
So I want you to sort of make your case, and we'll have a little more time to talk about it.
I was in Washington. I've been in Washington a few times, and couple of times I visited the Vietnam Memorial. And there was a high school and grammar school friend of mine whose name is on that memorial. And it's hard for me, though, to regard those soldiers as heroes exactly, in the same way that we can all stand up and sort of salute the Second World War. Second World War was really a unique war, in almost in human history. Vietnam was much more typical, I think. And it seemed to me they were more victims. They were victims of a misguided policy. We all supported the Vietnam War, of course, in 1964 and 65, but then, public opinion began to turn. Lyndon Johnson himself realized he was following a fool's errand, but he just couldn't bring himself to find a way out. But all those young soldiers continued to die fighting it. And I'm wondering whether we can, and I'm talking about in the fuller context of history. Obviously, if a soldier dies for his country, he's buried in the cemetery with full honors and fully memorialized. But in this notion about treating all soldiers as heroes, is it possible to be a hero in a misbegotten cause? Do we regard soldiers who brave soldiers who die in the cause of the Third Reich as heroes? Probably not. Do we regard soldiers who died in the cause of Imperial Japan as heroes? Probably not. So it just seems to me that there is a some sort of a gray space in the way a soldier is remembered, somewhere between hero and victim.
Charlie Kirk, your reaction to that?
I think it's an interesting thought. However, we have to look at also what the individual was thinking when they were fighting that war. Not necessarily whether it was misguided policy or not. You know, hindsight is 20/20. But that individual was fighting for the country, United States of America, for the principles of freedom and liberty. Whether it was through a draft or was it through voluntary service, I think it would be. I wouldn't do it personally. Call the people that died in Vietnam victims, if they were fighting for their brothers that they were serving in the battalion together with for America, whether or not it was a just war, I think it's a very, touchy subject no matter which way you approach it, but an interesting discussion to have.
Bruno?
I think you have to differentiate between the policy and the policymakers and the people who are actually in combat. Fact of the matter is that Vietnam may be a little bit different because it was the last war where we had a draft. And you could say that Vietnam ended, it was one of the reasons they ended the draft. And now at the very least, the people who are engaging in the wars post-Vietnam are all, it's all volunteers. So that kind of issue is taken off the table. But I would go so far as to say that if you died in war, at some level, you are a hero. Because you are fighting for your country, whether that country is right or wrong. We know that the Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany were the wrong nations, but those people who were in those wars were doing their duty as best as they saw fit, serving their country. And they, just because they happened to be on the losing side doesn't mean that they had less character or lower character. Just like there were people in all the wars that America's fought where American soldiers may have done things in battle that we wouldn't necessarily call heroic.
No, I wouldn't want it to reflect on their character at all. Okay. I exclude that entirely from the conversation. Hero or victim. And either way, you can be of great character.
John, you served your country.
Young people are idealistic in general, and they have nothing but the highest motives, except for the few that are remanded by judges in lieu of,
right,
an alternative to imprisonment or something. They're certainly heroes. I don't know. It's semantics. But I certainly think at the end of the day, what we're talking about is the enormous responsibility that falls upon those who send these young people off to these various causes. And I'd argue that Iraq and Afghanistan were a mistake. I think Obama knows now that Afghanistan was a mistake every time he listens to Mr. Karzai tell what he will and won't do. Still I hear, people very blithely saying, we ought to put Ukraine in NATO, sign a mutual defense treaty with, get involved in Syria. We ought to do this and do that. Boy, that just sends a chill up my spine.
Reckless
use of soldiers.
Absolutely.
But your point on, does everyone who dies in combat, are they heroes?
Is that
what defines a hero?
No.
Because they're certainly living heroes.
No, I think what you're fighting for determines whether you're a hero to a large extent.
The common denominator is they're fighting for their country.
Mm-hmm.
Their commander-in-chief, which they are certainly aware of when they enter the service, whether they're drafted or whether they volunteer, they know who the commander-in-chief is. They may not agree with that commander-in-chief. That commander-in-chief may be from a different party, but it is a bigger service. It's a commitment. And so if they do die, the way I look at it is someone is taking a spot that could have been mine.
Mm-hmm.
Someone stepped up and did something for their country. And in doing it for their country, some of them survived. Some of them did not survive. And I think what we talked about in the first hour, one of the great acts of disrespect that the country gives to those people is that when they do come back and they do have a mental, either a mental issue or a physical issue, or they've lost their limbs, to let them down at that point, I think that is the greatest disrespect that
can
a country
can regard a soldier who died in a Confederate soldier who died in the defense of slavery as dying in a heroic cause.
You know, actually, it's interesting you mention that. Read every letter they have documented Confederate soldiers. None of them say they were fighting for slavery. They were fighting for their country.
They were fighting for their country?
For their country or their region or what they consider the Confederacy.
Their
but they were never fighting for slavery. So it's wrong to misrepresent the Confederacy cause.
Their country being the Confederacy, though, right?
Well, yeah. Or the cause of the Confederacy, which was not
which
for
was
necessary
in
slavery.
The defense of slavery, which was to support
read
slavery.
The letter. They were never fighting for slavery.
1-800-723-8289. Please join us for our conversation. Dumont back. Thank you very much for joining us. So we're going to head to calls now. We're going to head to one of the most beautiful areas of the United States. It's Seneca Falls, upstate New York. Earl is listening to us on WTVA. Nice to hear from upstate New York. Go ahead, Earl.
Hello, Joe. Hello, folks.
Hello.
I'm a Navy veteran. I was a member of the commission crew of the USS Nimitz back 39 years. Years ago this May.
Thank you for serving.
I do get treatment at the VA, and it can be frustrating at times. But folks got to know that, especially, I go to the VA in Syracuse, and it's like tens of thousands of veterans that use the facility from active duty down to National Guards and those of us who have been out of the service. So it can be a little hectic at times, but what happened? What's going on now? Wow. That's really something. Find out what's happening down in Phoenix.
Has your medical treatment been something that you think highly of over the years?
I just know this, that the doctors and the nurses there in the VA system, they're trying their hardest and doing their best that they can, given that there are so many of us. I mean, after finally, I think the next biggest group is those of us that did serve in Vietnam, and those of us like myself who served outside the territorial waters of South Vietnam.
Earl, what is your reaction to the suggestion that was made earlier in the broadcast by Charlie Kirk that if there was a voucher that a veteran could walk into any health facility, any hospital, and be served, that might be more efficient and effective than a large bureaucracy than the one we have, or maybe certain types of medical procedures are handled within and a reduced VA system, and the other, either the more serious or the less serious medical treatment is handled at the local hospital.
I think that's a very good thing to do, because actually my primary care physician for colonoscopy, referred me to the local hospital over in Auburn, New York. So, mm-hmm. And the VA will pay the bill.
Hmm. All right, Earl, I want to ask you while you're on the phone and you've identified yourself as a Navy veteran. I want you to weigh in on a conversation we're having that John McDonough brought up, and that is whether or not someone who serves their country can be called a hero if they're involved in a war that some might view as a less than correct use of military force. You mentioned you're from the Vietnam era. I think John's referring to the war that you served in. I mean, is everyone that served in that war, in your view, a hero?
Oh, boy. When I signed up, it was just going from the draft to the volunteer force. And, oh, boy. I think many of the service personnel that especially went into and served in Vietnam.
I don't mean to put you on the spot. I thank you for your call. Again, thank you for your service.
By the way,
yes.
I live 1 mile east of the village of Waterloo. Back in by an act of Congress, the village of Waterloo, New York, is considered the birthplace of Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm. The birthplace of Memorial Day.
Y'all okay. Should come up here, especially during the fall.
Well, I've spent some time in upstate New York. It's a beautiful area, and thank you for calling from Seneca Falls, New York. Let's head to Benton Harbor, Michigan, where Ron is listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead, Ron. Are you there, Ron?
No, we just lost him.
Ron, are you gone? I guess he's gone.
I think the way John is framing the issue, I think he's onto something. If the point is that not everyone who serves or serves in whatever capacity in past wars is a hero, but I guess what I'd have to say is that you still have to look at what people are doing, particularly in a volunteer for armed service, where they're actually sacrificing time, effort, and a portion of their lives, and potentially sacrificing their life to keep us free.
I want to get reaction to a point that I asked John in the last hour, mm-hmm. but I didn't hear from the other guests. And the point was that, again, whether or not this was by design or not, the reality is those people who return from serving their country, who are coming back without limbs, they go into a segregated area where they're treated, called the veterans hospitals. Thus, they are kept out of the broader population of hospitals, which means they're put away. They're not seen by a lot of people. So I'm wondering, is that part of a maybe collective embarrassment that Congress created to basically put aside and hide those people who served their country and stepped up? God love them. But we don't want to be reminded every day, especially in the more recent years, where the devastation of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are at least they're more widely reported than previous wars. And I'm wondering if part of it is that we want to keep them out of the way. We don't want people walking in and seeing too many wounded veterans. John, is there anything to that?
I think, Bruce, that's too clever by half. That sounds like small group of willful men and smoke. I think it's just something evolved much more like John.
Is it an unintended consequence?
I think, well, sure. If you have a separate system. I mean, less than 1% of our population now is involved at all in direct military activity. And now that we have a volunteer army, I mean, it's very remote. I think it's more like what John McDonough explains, that this began as this was our first healthcare system because we had nothing. I mean, in the Civil War, with families went to the battlefield and took care of their. So, I mean, it's more a historical accident. And what it's evolved into is this bureaucracy. So I find myself rather awkwardly agreeing with my libertarian friends on the other side of the table. Maybe the vouchers are the way to go.
Charlie.
I think there is some legitimacy to what you're saying, and I think you're onto something. It's nothing new, though, whether it was the blackouts during the Vietnam War
or whether it was the Bush administration not allowing the media circuits to cover the bodies coming home. There's always been a theme, at least in the modern era, of covering wars since the Vietnam War. It was really the first war that was on television where people came home every day and could watch coverage on it to try to distance the brutality of war from the American public. And I think that this might be another side effect, intentional or not. I couldn't pass judgment on that. But I do think that you're onto something that is part of whether it's Washington or just society at large, that we do want distance away from war. And I think
in support of your notion, and it hadn't occurred to me, but as I think about it, the great film director John Huston was one of a number of American film directors who went into the service and produced films. And one of them was Let There Be Light. And it was a documentary that Huston made toward the end of the war dealing with, in effect, shell shock and the mental and emotional impact that the war was having on soldiers. And the film was shot, it was filmed and edited, and the Pentagon, in effect, crushed it, censored it, wouldn't permit its release for 25 or 30 years. Finally became public in the 1960s or 70s. Huston was still alive. And it's considered an important film of its kind now, but there was that small group of people in the Pentagon who did not want that film out there.
Chris in Auburn, Illinois, listening to us on WLS. Go ahead.
Hi, Bruce. I'm retired from the Navy, and I'm not sure which one of your panelists said it, but I'm really insulted by the discussion about it depends on what war you were in or what combat situation you were in, whether or not you were a hero. I went in 1970. My first duty station, we had a Master Chief bosun's mate that had served on Rivercraft in Vietnam. He jumped on a grenade that got thrown onto his Rivercraft. Luckily, it never went off, so he lived. That man, no matter what war it was, would have been a hero, and he was a hero. I always have looked up to that man.
I would agree with that.
That's very convincing.
That's a very convincing case.
But I would say is that in the larger historic context, all soldiers are instruments of the policy they're fighting for. They don't have control of that. That's the responsibility of their leaders. And to the extent that their leaders are in error, that unfortunately creates great tragedy for soldiers.
Chris, on that note, we have to say farewell to you. Thank you again, and thank you very much for your service. And again, everyone else that is listening to the broadcast this evening, if you've served your country, we do appreciate that. And again, don't forget tomorrow we want special treatment, remembering those. Take a moment tomorrow to remember those that gave their lives for this country. When we come back, we're going to be heading to California, and we're going to introduce our national audience to a man who wants to be governor of California. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. You may recall a couple of months ago when we were doing this broadcast from California, we had Tim Donnelly as a guest on this program. He is one of those running for governor of the state of California, very active in the party, specifically a member of the General Assembly or the State Assembly out there. And one of his chief opponents for that mantle is Anil Kashkari. He joins us now. Mr. Kashkari, thank you very much for being with us on Beyond the Beltway. It's nice to have you with us.
No, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. Please call me Neil.
I will do it, Neil. We should mention, by the way, that since we do this program from Chicago, you are a science and math master and bachelor's degree in engineering from the University of Illinois. So you've spent some time in Illinois. But my question to you is, in looking at some of the polls and also talking with many Republican political operatives when I was out there, they seem to think that Jerry Brown is unusually popular. So why do you want to take him on and throw him out of work?
Sure. Jerry Brown is well-liked. He's kind of like everybody's uncle. Nobody hates your uncle. But unfortunately, the state is in a lot of trouble. The middle class has been destroyed over the past 30 years. We're ranked nationally 47th for jobs. We're ranked 46th for education. And we're number one in poverty. And Jerry Brown has the audacity to call it the California comeback. For most California families, they have no idea what he's talking about because it's not back for them. And I want to rebuild the middle class. Someone's got to do it. Jerry Brown's certainly not up to the task.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk more about that, and we have guests around the table here in Chicago that have some follow-up questions for you. But I would be remiss if I did not get your thought and your opinion on the tragedy that took place in Santa Barbara involving the loss of life and just your reaction to it. And is this one of those stories, Neil, that could just never have been avoided?
You know, it seems like it. Obviously, it's just a horrible, horrible tragedy for the families, for the victims, for all of us, you know, care about our state, care about our country. It's very, very tragic. And you look at some of the facts that have come out, and I don't know, you know, I don't want to place the blame. I know the folks investigating this young man were doing their very best, and sometimes these things are so hard to predict. But, you know, we all need to look hard at our mental health laws and really see if we're taking all protections we can. So many of these tragedies come down to mental health issues, and I think we need to focus on how to understand those issues and deal with those, which are really the root cause of many of these tragedies.
Is there a gun-related issue that needs to be explored as well?
You know, I'm a gun owner myself. I've been a gun owner for years, and I take my gun responsibilities very seriously. From what I understand, this young man stabbed three people to death before he went on his shooting spree. You know, I think we need to focus on the root cause of this, really, which seems to me, and I don't want to rush to judgment because the facts are still coming out, but from what we know so far, it really seems to be a mental health issue. Whether it's a knife or a gun in the hands of somebody who's mentally disturbed, it's going to do a lot of damage.
Neil, let me ask you a question that a lot of the political operatives have certainly been talking about as they focus on your campaign and this primary that's coming up in early June, that you are part of a national movement in the fight for the heart and soul of the Republican Party. Do you see your race in that bigger, broader fight for the party's future?
You know, I think so. One of my goals in running for governor of California, of course, number one is to beat Jerry Brown, rebuild the middle class. But number two is I want to show all of California and, frankly, the country that the Republican Party is the party of hard work, that our economic ideas are the right ideas to help everyone get ahead. And I want to grow our party. I want to bring every ethnic group back into the Republican Party, every socioeconomic group. And my message is simple. If you want to work hard and build a better life for yourself, then this is the party for you, the Republican Party. And if that means helping to take the party in a more positive, inclusive direction, then I'm all for it. And I would be very proud to help lead that effort.
Charlie Kirk is executive director and founder of an organization called Turning Point USA. He joins us in studio, and he has a question for you.
Yeah, thank you, Neil, for being here. I really love your message, rebuild the middle class. Not enough Republicans talk about that. I know very well that the California tax system is disproportionately, I would say, punishing to very, very successful people at almost, I think, 12.3%, if I'm not mistaken, for people that earn almost $500,000 a year. Are you experiencing a brain drain in California or a lot of companies leaving? Because if they're earning substantial wages, they ask themselves, well, if I go to Nevada or even Arizona, I'm not going to have 12% of my income taken from me. The first question is, are you seeing a brain drain happening? And also, what would you do to address some of the high tax rates on success in California?
Sure. Well, it's a great question. We are absolutely, by the way, it's actually 13.3%, so it's even worse than you thought. We are absolutely seeing factories and businesses leave. But you know what? I'm not that concerned about the CEO of that business, whether or not he's in California or Nevada. We want him here in California. But the thing that kills all of us is when those factories leave, and the middle-class jobs go with it, and it's the middle-class families that are really hurt by this. So just a couple weeks ago, Toyota announced that they're going to move their headquarters out of California. And what did Jerry Brown say? He said, well, it's not really my fault. These things happen. Oh, well. That's not good enough. You know, this is a product of failed government policy in Sacramento. It's the taxes are part of it, but it's also regulation that's out of control that is really making California uncompetitive, basically being...
Hello? Go ahead. Are you still there?
He's dropping out.
Hello? Are you there? We're running into a little technical problem, so let's have our producers call Neil back. Let us know when he's back on the line, okay, because he was in the middle of a – it sounded like he was in on a cell.
I think it was interesting what he's saying, though. Obviously, his main theme is to rebuild the middle class and – You know, Bruno, what do you think? You know, you're a fellow conservatarian.
Well, no. First of all,
a Republican running in California. I mean, they're just like here in Illinois. They are up against such a juggernaut of power. I mean, if you're not doing things like Scott Walker in Wisconsin, if you are not curtailing the power of the public employee unions and the sheer clout that they wield in a place like California, I don't really know that you can do much to change it. This is a state that it has to have 13% income tax rates to fund a system that isn't working again, whether it's the prison guards, whether it's the municipal employees, whether it's the teachers unions. This is a state that's being bled dry by public employment. And if you aren't cutting vast swaths of public employment in places like California or Illinois, you're not solving the problem.
All right, let's come back. Neil, are you back with us again?
I'm here. Sorry about that. I'm driving through farm country. Don't have the best cell service right now.
That's okay. The question was, you were answering the question about a brain drain, and Bruno Barrando also was asking the question about how do you go about creating jobs.
I'll just make it very quick here. How can you fix California if you don't slash the spending that's driving the taxes, and the spending is all in unbelievably large payroll for public employees and across all public systems?
Look, I agree that that's a big problem, but that's, to me, not the root cause of this. Today, we have 17% of Californians with no job or a part-time job. We need to grow the economy, create good private sector jobs, put people back to work, which will broaden our tax base, create more tax revenue, and then we can lower taxes, which then will have a virtuous cycle of even faster economic growth and more investment. So, yes, look, we have $500 billion of unfunded pension liabilities that we're unhooked for in California, not dissimilar to Illinois. We need to address this. But to me, step one is putting people back to work, lower the unemployment rate, and then step two, we start taking on our huge fiscal issues as well.
Your opponent, your primary opponent, is Assemblyman Donnelly. Is there a role for the Tea Party or Tea Party Republicans in your administration if you were to make it to Sacramento?
Absolutely. I think the Tea Party represents a very energized, passionate group within the broader framework of the Republican Party. And one of my goals is to unite all Republicans around the message of hard work, pro-growth economic policy, fiscal responsibility. These are ideas that Tea Party Republicans and all Republicans can get behind. And by the way, I think independents and I think some moderate Democrats do. So, yes, absolutely.
And for those people that would say, again, those listening nationally with your background, you were undersecretary, assistant secretary of the Treasury. You were involved in the TARP program. You come out of Goldman Sachs. These are credentials that may help you in a business sense, but some of those things may be toxic politically. Would you acknowledge that some of the strengths that you have might be perceived as political weaknesses?
Well, I just take the TARP. I was appointed by President Bush. We were a free market Republican administration. We were angry about the financial crisis. We wanted to let all the banks fail because they deserved to fail. But when the economy was on the brink of collapse, that's when President Bush said we have to step in on behalf of the American people. But if we're going to step in, we're going to protect the taxpayers. So I'm proud that we got Republicans and Democrats to work together. We stabilized the economy. We then got all the taxpayers' money back and even made a $13 billion profit for the taxpayers. So nobody was angrier than us about it, but we worked together and we made the best of a bad situation, and I'm proud of that record.
Would you acknowledge that it might be toxic to some people? I mean, you've made a very strong defense of it, but would you acknowledge at least that for some people, they may not get that message or believe you?
Oh, sure. Look, understood. Look, there's no issue. I don't think there's any issue in America that everyone is going to agree with 100% of the time. But I just keep going back to what is the state of the middle class in California? The middle class has been destroyed, and Jerry Brown is running on a message of the California comeback. You know, if he thinks that 47th out of 50 states is good enough for jobs and 46th out of 50 is good enough for education, well, I really feel bad for him because we're going to go rebuild the middle class, and he's absolutely vulnerable because of his record.
Neil Kashkari is our guest. He joins us from California. Wherever you're listening around the country, we thank you very much for being with us. We're going to continue with another segment, giving Mr. Kashkari an opportunity to make his case for the voters of California and also introduce him to our national audience. Thanks for being with us tonight. Back with more of Neil Kashkari in a moment. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're talking with Neil Kashkari. He is in California. He wants to be the governor of the state of California. And, Neil, I want to talk about this, and then we have some Democratic guests who have a question or two for you. And that is the image of the Republican Party. What do you think that image is now? And what, if you were to be the standard bearer of that party, what would it mean and how would you go about changing that image?
Yeah, too often in recent years, the Republican Party has come across or been perceived as the party of no, the party that doesn't care about minorities or doesn't care about women or regular Americans or regular Californians. That's part of why I want to. That's part of why I'm running, is I want to change that. I want people to think of the Republican Party, as I said earlier, as the party of hard work. Where, look at me. I'm a young man. My parents came here from India 50 years ago. I grew up middle class. You know, I went to the University of Illinois, as you said. I took out loans to go to graduate school. I've lived the American dream. I got a good education, and this country has been phenomenal to me. I want every kid in California to have that same shot, and I want them to look at the Republican Party as a party that wants everyone to get ahead. And if you want to work hard and you want to play by the rules and build a better life for yourself, then we want you with us. Well, the Republican Party is the biggest tent you've ever seen in your life. That's my vision for the Republican Party. And if I can help to portray that image around California and around the country, boy, I'd be really proud of that and happy to be part of it.
Do you believe in this campaign that because you are an Indian American, that has been that there are those that are attempting to use that against you in this campaign?
You know, I don't know. I mean, my opponent recently came out. I'm a Hindu, and he accused me of promoting Sharia law. It's utterly absurd. I worked for President Bush at the Treasury Department, and he accused the Bush Treasury Department of trying to bring Islamic law to America. Some people have said that he was trying to, you know, play the race card or race baiting. I don't know if that was his intention or not. As I travel around California, one of the things that's been wonderful, every group that I visited, whether it's Caucasian groups or Latinos or African Americans or Asians, people have welcomed me with open arms. They don't care that my parents are from India. They don't care that I'm a Republican. They just care that I care about what their lives are like and what their hopes and dreams are. And so I've been really energized by that. Whether my opponent wants to try to play racial games, you know, I'll leave that up to him.
For those listening around the country, take 30 seconds and explain the uniqueness of your primary. You have a unique primary, first time that's ever been handled this way in California. What's unique about it?
Yeah, so it's called an open primary where all the candidates are on the ballot together, and Republicans, independents, and Democrats all vote together, and the top two vote recipients go to the general election in November. So our primary is on June 3rd. There are literally 15 people on the ballot. Jerry Brown will almost certainly be number one. He's the incumbent. And then myself and another Republican named Assemblyman Tim Donnelly are competing for the number two spot. And whoever the top two vote getters are will face each other in the November election.
John McDonough is here. He is a card-carrying Democrat, but he's got a question for you.
Neil, out in California, you have about a quarter of the nation's homeless veterans, and the ballot that you're going to be running on has a Proposition 41, the Vietnam Housing and Homeless Prevention Act. And I was wondering if you could talk a little about that and tell me where you land on that one.
Yeah, I'm in support of that. Look, I visited a homeless shelter or a shelter for veterans that need housing assistance in Los Angeles. We all know this. I mean, we're seeing what's happening in Washington now. We need to do a lot better taking care of our veterans who've given so much for us. And I think that this act that's on the ballot is one small way to help make a difference in their lives. But I think that there's more that we can do. You know, I've visited a lot of homeless shelters around California, not just for veterans. And what I found is more often than not, they're full of people who want to work. They're full of the working poor, people who can't find a job or stuck in a part-time job and can't afford their own place to live. And so for me, growing the economy so that there are more good jobs available is one of the key remedies to help bring down the homeless rate in California for veterans and for everyone.
What are the expenses that are involved in Proposition 41?
You know, I don't have those details at my fingertips on exactly what the budget implications are for that, but happy to follow back up with you on that. But I've said many times, and I know I'm not the first one to say it, that the best social program in the world is a good job. And what I think Sacramento fails to appreciate is that every time they come out with new rules and regulations that make the state less economically competitive, it ends up hurting middle-class families who just want a fair chance to work hard.
Neil, and so I look at all of these programs through the lens of what does it do for jobs for regular Californians.
Neil, in the first part of our broadcast when we were talking about the scandal at the VAA, Charlie Kirk came up with an idea, not necessarily unique to Charlie, but it's a voucher concept. In that maybe, you know, maybe the VA isn't really needed anymore. That maybe if you're a veteran, you should be able to go to any hospital and have your card, your veteran's card. But this is a way to begin the process of breaking up a bureaucracy that is backlogged and you know, scandalous.
I think that sounds like a very interesting idea worth exploring. But by the way, that flies in the face of the direction that the current president is trying to take the country with health care. And so I'd be very interested to hear what he and the Democratic leaders in Washington would have to say about that, because you know they've been pushing us now for a few years that single payer is the holy grail. Let's go to single payer, and they had to compromise with Obamacare. Well, we're kind of seeing what single payer leads to in the VA and the way it's being administered. So I think we should look at all of these creative ideas to improve health care for our veterans and for all Americans.
John McCarron is here, longtime journalist in the Chicagoland area. John?
Neil, I'm really here to be the liberal whipping boy on this panel, but truth be told, no. But I had to give you a compliment. Not only you, but the Republican line here in Illinois is, you know, do something to save the middle class, and it's to me it's great political jujitsu that after American finance capitalism exports the means of production to communist China because they work for so much less than we will, and after we fill our stores with Chinese goods, that you can turn around and blame high taxes, labor unions, and rules and regulations for the erosion
Neil,
of the American 20, middle class.
You got 20 seconds to tackle that one.
Yeah, you know what? Let's just talk about income inequality. The root cause of income inequality is a failure of K-12. And until the Democratic Party is willing to really take on bold K-12 transformative reforms, we're never going to tackle income inequality. So as a Republican, I think the Republican Party should own this issue because, frankly, we're the only ones willing to make the transformational change to make sure kids get a good education and then can compete all around the world.
Neil Kashkari, we're out of time. Thank you very much. Neil Kashkari, he wants to be the next governor of the state of California. June 3rd is the primary. Thank you very much for being with us. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks this evening to Dan Dorfman and Todd Nebel for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dick Cavett.
He's one of the greatest television interviewers of all time. The legendary Dick Cavett is coming to Chicago.
There's a certain excitement in the air.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications presents a salute to Dick Cavett, Saturday, June 21st at 6:30.
But this is me. I'm letting it all hang out.
Spend an evening with a television legend.
Why don't we see how the show is?
A salute to Dick Cavett. Go to museum.tv for your tickets now.